Welcome. You are tuned into 2SER 107.3, and the show that you have tuned into is called Final Draft. Now, Final Draft is a half hour of books, writing, and literary culture every week. My name is Andrew Popel, and it is my great pleasure to be able to bring to you some of the greatest Australian writers working today. It's an opportunity to look at their work, to look at what it says about who we are. Art is such an important part of the way we shape and also process everything that goes on for us. It's also a great way to just kind of chill out and enjoy stories. Today, I think I have something that will help you do both, but I want to begin by acknowledging that 2SER broadcasts from the lands of the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation. I am recording on the lands of the Darug and Gunungurra people. I want to acknowledge the traditional owners of those lands. I want to acknowledge that it is stolen land. The treaty was never reached in Australia. Now, this is a great week to be a reader. I'm just thinking, off the top of my head, we have got the Stella Prize winner being announced this week, coming up on Thursday night. If you want to find out a little bit more, now the Stella Prize is the premier award for women and non-binary writers in Australia. It is an absolutely fantastic event. 12 books, narrowed down to 6, narrowed down to 1, but every single one, just an incredible experience. And if you want to find out a little bit more about the Stella Prize and find out a little bit more about the shortlist of authors, you can go to the Final Draft podcast, wherever you get your podcasts, and catch up. I did have a conversation with Zoya Patel, who is the head of the judging panel. Find out a little bit more before the prize is announced on Thursday. We are also so close, within reaching distance of Sydney Writers Festival. All this month, I've been bringing you conversations with artists who are appearing on the lineup, and today is no exception. Today on the show, I'm going to be joined by Emily Maguire. She is she's the author of 6 books of fiction, 3 books of nonfiction. She has been shortlisted for the Stella. She's been shortlisted for the Miles Franklin. And today she has a fantastic new work out. It is called Love Objects. It centers around the relationship between an aunt and her niece, and just the most extraordinary dynamic between them. As Lena, who's returned to Sydney to study, she regularly meets up with her aunt, but one day when her aunt doesn't turn up for their regular lunch date, she goes to Nick's house and makes an incredible discovery. I'm really excited to share this conversation. It has so much to say about our world. And that is what's coming up on Final Draft today, just after this very short break.
Sydney Writers Festival's brightest stars come together at Sydney Town Hall on Friday, April 30, for a centrepiece event celebrating the festival theme, Within Reach. Featuring Tony Birch, Trent Dalton, Geraldine Brooks, Ceridwen Dovey, Adam Goods, Fiona McGregor, Michael O'Loughlin, Christos Tsholkas, Maria Tomarkin, and Ellen Van Nierven. Sydney Writers Festival, April 26 to May 2. Program out now at swf.org.au. Sydney Writers Festival sponsors 2SER 107.3.
You are tuned into 2SER 107.3. This is Final Draft. I am Andrew Popel, and can you hear the smile in my voice? I've got such a fantastic conversation about to start. I am speaking with Emily Maguire. Emily is the author of 6 novels, 3 nonfiction books. She's been nominated for the Stella Prize and the Miles Franklin. She's been published widely in SMH, The Australian and The Age. She's talked to us here on Final Draft before, but today we have her fantastic new novel. It is called Love Objects. Emily, it is so great to be chatting again.
Oh, great for me too. Thank you.
Now, in Love Objects, Lena and Will, they grew up worshipping their auntie Nick. Her house was an escape from home. She supported their every endeavour unconditionally. But when Nick's sister Michelle moved the family to Brisbane, she was devastated. Now Lena's back in Sydney and studying. Every Sunday, she and Nick meet up for lunch. But one week, when auntie Nick misses their date on a Sunday, Lena goes in search of her aunt, only to make a shocking discovery. That feels like a bit of a clickbait, and there's so much incredible things happening in Love Objects. It explores so much territory that's relevant, it's indeed necessary to our world today, but at its heart is that relationship between the 3 central characters. Emily, I love your eye for people. I love your deeply realized characters in all of your books that I've read. Nick, Lena, and Will are extraordinary in their strengths as well as in their flaws. How do you introduce them to people, though?
Thank you for that lovely introduction. Nick, to me, is this sort of tough, street-smart, middle-aged woman. She's a lifelong and proud checkout chick. She has a really safe and happy life, except the one flaw in it, although this is not how she thinks of it, is that she has a lot of stuff, and this is the level of stuff that she, you know, can't fully open her front door. She has to turn on the side to walk through the really narrow passageways. There's just so much stuff. And again, from the outside, it looks like a disaster area, but to her, it's a treasure trove and a real haven. She loves her home. She loves her stuff. Lena is her niece who is at university. She's a little bit older than the other first-year students because it's been a bit of a struggle for her to get there. It was never a foregone conclusion that she would be at university. She's the first in her family. And she feels fairly self-conscious about that. She feels like she doesn't quite fit in. But like you said in the intro, she absolutely worships and looks after her Auntie Nick and, you know, does the what would Auntie Nick do thinking when she's in tricky situations that she doesn't know how to handle. Will is Lena's brother. He made a terrible mistake when he was younger, when he was 18, went to prison for a couple of months, and it wasn't a particularly serious charge, and it was a fairly low-key experience as far as prison experiences go, but the stain of that has followed him, and now in his mid-20s, he's having a lot of trouble actually restarting the life that he feels was cut off at that point.
And I think with Will, you've kind of touched on something that is quite important as it emerges with each of the characters, that Will has something in his past that he's struggling to come to terms with, but also struggling to come to terms with the way other people will come to terms with it. And as I thought about how I wanted to talk about all of the events of Love Objects, I didn't know how I felt about kind of revealing what's going on with Nick, and especially putting a label on it, which is something that does happen in the book. You build up to it so perfectly, and something about the way we travel with Nick in her perspective that makes, I guess, the revelation quite jarring. It also had me thinking about how often the greatest mysteries are kind of the things that we keep from others.
Yeah, it was really important to me with Nick that I sort of made sure that I was telling, you know, her sections of the book anyway, very much from her deep point of view. Like that was my absolute priority in writing this novel. And what's really important is that any label that others will, and they do later in the book, slap on her, like hoarder, it bears no relationship to how she sees herself or her life. She is really content and really happy and gets genuine comfort from all that stuff around her. And if it's not for the fact that she has an accident and so Lena finds her like that, there's no reason for her to feel that she is a problem, she is a burden, she has a mental illness, any of these things that other people will go on to say about her. It just bears no relationship to her self-conception, and that was really, really important when I was writing. The complicated thing in there is that she knows enough about how other people will react that she does keep her home as a kind of a secret. She doesn't invite her beloved niece over there. They always meet in a restaurant. She doesn't have friends over. She's got mates at work. It's not that she's ashamed of it, I don't think, but she knows that other people will sort of impose some kind of narrative or label on her if they see her place. And so it is a real lovely thing to her, but that she knows that she can't let other people see.
As we move with Nick through her life, very deeply within her perspective, there's such a tenderness to Nick's descriptions of her things. And when she discovers something new to the way that she crafts a space for it in her life, she relates to the world that she's built for herself. She loves these things in such so many deep ways. How did you get yourself into that mindset and appreciate this empathy that Nick was creating?
Yeah, I actually did a huge amount of research on people with hoarding behaviour, which is the term I sort of broadly use because there's a lot of stuff around labelling and diagnoses and all of that, which I'm not in the business of affirming or using those kind of terms necessarily. But people like Nick who do tend to hang on to everything that passes through their hands. And something that struck me again and again was the tenderness and the care that people who tend to hang on a lot of stuff have about that stuff, that to an outsider coming in, it can look like these people are being so careless, they've just dumped all this stuff, they don't even know what's in there, it's just, you know, piles of things. But once you start talking and you ask about individual objects, there's always a story, sometimes multiple stories. There will be the story of how that person came to have that thing, but there might also be stories about how it was made or who owned it beforehand. And in the case of Nick, she sometimes knows what those stories are, and when she doesn't, she imagines them. And it's a really creative mindset of seeing items as sort of frozen stories or living stories that carry all this weight of emotion and effort. And to discard those things feels like discarding those stories, those people, or disrespecting them in some way.
My mind's going in a million different directions at the moment, and it really strikes me, as I look to my left, I've got my bookshelves where literally all of the books that I collect have a story, or people that have a wine cellar and can tell a story about, you know, individual bottles and the way those experiences are coded differently to what we're talking about here with Nick. And a central tension of Love Objects is Nick's feeling that she's doing really well in her life. She's managing, she's thriving in her way of living in the world. This is seemingly supported by her life prior to a culminating event that we haven't named yet. We'll keep it a bit secret. But now that she's vulnerable, she's subject to other people's standards and their perceptions of, I guess in scare quotes, the right way that she should live. Now, hoarding at a problematic level, it impacts, I guess, a relatively small proportion of the population. Although when I was doing my research, I was surprised to learn that this could be as many as 2-6% of the population. But this tension, though, of living your life in a way that other people deem to be appropriate is a much larger issue. So I wanted maybe if we can talk a little bit about gatekeeping in general. Are we just as a society too much in other people's faces about the way you should live and like the right way?
Yeah, look, it's such an interesting question, and I am kind of obsessed with it, which is part of what's driving this novel, because I guess the flip side of that question, or maybe it's a companion question, is do we leave each other alone too much or leave certain people alone too much? You know, how do we care for each other as family members or as community members or as members of the world? How much, you know, what do we owe each other in terms of care? And when does that become invading someone's privacy, telling them how to live, telling them what's best for them? It's a really sort of complicated set of questions. One of the reasons why it was, there's several reasons why I wanted this to be a story about an auntie and her niece and nephew, but one of them was thinking about the more obvious immediate family relationships, at least in the sort of Anglo culture I grew up in. It's kind of expected that kids and parents will be responsible for each other if something goes wrong, or that they know what's going on with each other. Now, that obviously doesn't always happen, but there's this sort of cultural expectation of it. But once you kind of get one step removed from that, that expectation isn't there. I don't think anyone would generally in this culture expect a 20-year-old young woman to bother so much about her auntie to the degree of really getting stuck into her business. And so I wanted to kind of push harder at that idea of love and relationships and who we care for and who's in our circles and the positive side of that. But then, of course, the negative side of how, you know, should you help someone who doesn't want help, who doesn't think they need help? And It is a really complicated thing. I think it's something that many people, if you are in a close family or a close friendship group, or maybe just keeping an eye on your neighbours down the road, at some point confront this idea of how hard do I push this? I think this person's not doing well. I think there's something wrong here, but they're saying they're fine. Do I just back off?
It's such a beautiful but complicated relationship that you show us between Nick and Lena. Nick loves her like a daughter. She harkens back to these memories of their life together. There's a whole section in her house devoted to both Lena and to Will. But she also, she really struggles to resolve, I guess, feelings of fear and also anger that the relationship might be compromised. And particularly she thinks about how it was compromised by Lena's mum when the family moved to Brisbane. You really got me thinking there, though, about those ways that we extend love, the ways we extend our circle. I mean, this is something that it felt like everyone wanted to think about and everyone wanted to write about 12 months ago, because our circles seemed to shrink when we were reduced to the four walls of our house. And, you know, people were dropping toilet rolls and handwritten notes to neighbours. And I wonder if that was a very in-the-moment thing, or whether we can, you know, like your book is obviously signaling these things to us, but will we retain that idea that community can extend and expand and that we can be more a part of each other's lives?
Yeah, I wonder about that too. I really hope so. I mean, there's some, I think some really, to use an often overused word, but I think relevant in this case, I think a lot of people had epiphanies about who their people were during that time, depending on how bad the lockdown was in the particular area that people were in. But I think it did force most of us to really think about who our circle of care was, and sometimes that's blood relatives and sometimes family that we've created for ourselves. Some people really, you know, sadly realised that they didn't have anyone that they would automatically check in with every day, and whether that's something they wanted to change. All these kind of questions, I think, have definitely come up. But like you said, whether we will retain that when things, you know, who knows if they will actually. I don't want to say go back to normal, because I don't know if that's necessarily an entirely good thing. But when there's less of a threat of being physically isolated from each other, whether people who have had some kind of breakthrough in their thinking will go back to just sort of taking for granted the fact that there'll always be someone around.
I want to diverge a little here and come to Lena, because I guess one way that these caring relationships are often figured, quite often seems to be a power dynamic where someone feels that someone needs care, which can put them in a power position over that person. But art, as in life, is never quite so simple. And as Lena's trying to support Nick, she's also confronted with her own terrible situation, which she struggles to admit that she needs support with. So in the story, Lena finds herself in a position where she's been filmed without her permission, and now there's a sex tape that prominently features her. It's online. It's seemingly going viral. In the conversations that I'm so fortunate to have week in, week out with authors, I found myself quite often kind of excusing the fact that I'm starting to draw parallels with the fiction that I'm reading and the lives that we're living today. Books that were obviously written months or years before the discussions we're having right now, seemingly reflecting them so well. So whilst I know that in writing Love Objects, you may not have known that we'd be having this national discussion around the abhorrent behaviours that men just presumably seem to think they'll get away with, I wondered if the sort of behaviours, responses, conversations, like anonymous messages that you depict, are they, you know, that's the atmosphere that's fueling the rage that we're now seeing released, isn't it?
Yeah, it's so interesting because, yeah, obviously when I wrote this novel, certainly the earlier draft of it, this national conversation wasn't happening, but women's conversations and young women's conversations have been full of this stuff for a really long time, which is why now this sort of larger national conversation where our Prime Minister is suddenly realising certain things that have been happening for a really long time and that women have been rightly angry about for a long time. you know, it does feel kind of really frustrating in a way, because for many of us, none of this is new. It's just like for whatever reason, it's broken through to be this on the national agenda. I guess the reason is that there's several incidents in Parliament House, which is like literally where the national agenda is made. But yeah, what happens to Lena is reasonably common. I mean, not necessarily in the real specifics, but I think, you know, without giving everything away, I think the specifics of what happens to her, she hooks up with someone very willingly and has a really good time. And it was important to me to really get that across, that she's not being victimized in terms of the actual hookup with this guy. But what happens after that is where the betrayal comes and the lack of consent comes. And that's really, in this case, an act of, it's not really about her at all. It's about boys or young men bonding with each other. And I think that is something that at least some of these stories that are on the national agenda now really have in common, that it's women are victimised in a particular way, but when it comes down to it, it's really about men's relationships to each other and what they're proving to each other or not. And that's something that I find particularly, I don't know, galling, because you know, we use this word dehumanisation a lot, but it feels very much like it's not just the act itself or the behaviour itself that can make a woman or girl feel dehumanised, but it's the fact that she's not even the point. It's not even about hurting a woman or hurting Lena in this case. It's about these other observers, these other men.
You also work throughout the novel, I guess, that sort of mindset of normalization of fear and vigilance, this idea of situational awareness that women have to live with. Very early on, Nick talks about how, you know, she's a lifelong dedicated checkout chick, and she likes the late shift because it pays better, but she knows even calm, reasonable women don't go walking after midnight. Even Lena struggles to... And I think many of the characters, as they find out about what's happened to Lena, struggle to understand how she didn't protect herself. It's this idea of victim blaming. And I wonder if some of these bonding rituals, what you're talking about here, the way men discuss women as if they're not people, play into the way these narratives are. Like the whole thing has been normalized. So now that people are calling it out, now that we're talking about it, it does seem quite jarring to certain segments of the population who thought this was just a thing that got done.
Yeah. Yeah. It's, this stuff goes so deep and it's so multi-layered. It's very complicated. The victim blaming thing, I think when that's really obvious surface level, people are really good at calling that out now. You will rarely hear maybe someone straight out say she asked for it. But there's shades of that we still hear all the time. And again, a situation like Lena's, if you're a woman who is attracted to men and wants to act on that, that should be and very often is, thankfully, a great and fun thing to do. But if it does go badly, there is still this sense, well, what did you expect? And I think it's this real cognitive dissonance that growing up as a girl or as a straight girl woman in this society, you are supposed to simultaneously hold this idea in your head that men are the potential partners and, you know, sources of hopefully mutual pleasure and all the rest of it, but also they're dangerous beasts that you should be afraid of. And you're not allowed to say that at all. It's very offensive to group all men in together, and who would do that? But if you are assaulted or something happens, there is this reaction, didn't you know that men are dangerous beasts and you should have been more careful? It's tough.
I'm speaking with Emily Maguire. The book we are discussing is Love Objects. It is a gorgeous book full of discovery, as the cover is. Emily, thank you so much for taking the time.
Oh, it was a real pleasure. Thank you very much.
This week on Death of the Reader, another Japanese classic with Yukito Ayatsuji's The Decagon House Murders.
Are you a big fan of magic tricks? You know,
maybe.
Because apparently, according to the novel we're going to be covering, murder mystery fans often do enjoy magic tricks.
Sundays at 9 p.m, Thursdays at 7:30 p.m, and all your favorite podcast apps. Death of the Reader, your murder mystery world tour here on 2SER 107.3.
To SER. We wish you were here. Subscribe today at 2SER.com.
You are tuned into 2SER 107.3, and yes, we wish you were here. I'm Andrew Popel, and the show you are listening to is Final Draft. Wish You Are Here is a fundraiser that 2SER is doing at the moment. Go to 2SER.com to join us, to support us. Everyone who joins goes in the running to win an Audio-Technica turntable pack as well. You just get a 2SER bumper sticker, a membership card, and a Listening Post magazine. Thank you so much to Emily Maguire, who joined me today. Emily, you will be able to catch her at Sydney Writers Festival. Just go to swf.org for all the details of all the incredible writers. Before I let you go, also don't forget Stella Prize this week. Such a big announcement, such an important prize. I am really excited to find out who wins. What have I forgotten? Listen to the podcast. Emily and I chatted for ages, and I would love to share the full conversation. It's going to be going up on the podcast after the show. Thank you so much. My name is Andrew Popel. I'm going to leave you with a song. I'm going to leave you with a track. This is from Brisbane-based artist Asher Jeffries. It's called Crybaby. Till next week with Final Draft, I wish you happy reading. Bye now.
Life is dying. We're driving away, but we don't light up the same anymore. I'm head over heels for my life again. And you're head over heels for the wrong reasons. Sitting since the lockdown, baby, and the breeze came, and I think I don't know how to change. Could be quite over. So